Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all parties are going to be on a listen-only mode. During the question and answer session, please press star one on your touch-tone phone. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I now would like to turn the conference call over to Monica Allen, and ma'am, you may begin.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for calling in. We're really excited about the big turnout on the call this morning. My name is Monica Allen. I am the Director of Public Affairs for NOAA Research, and I have with me today three wonderful experts who will be giving you a media briefing. We also welcome constituents on a listen only on the Great Lakes water levels. And so again, I just wanted to say that we will be having the presentations by the three experts. Then after that, we'll have a chance for questions, and the media will be able to press their button and ask questions. And thank you again for calling in. So we have with us today from NOAA's Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory, Drew Grunewald, who is a hydrologist for NOAA. And we have Stephen Gill, who is a senior scientist at NOAA's Center for Operational Oceanographic Products and Services. And we have Keith Kompoltowitz, who is the Watershed Hydrology Branch Chief at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in the Detroit District. And now I will turn this over to Drew. Oh, I wanted to spell their names because I know sometimes that's difficult. Let me do that very quickly. Drew is D-R-E-W, G-R-O-N-E-W-O-L-D, and again, he's the hydrologist for NOAA's Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory. And Stephen Gill, that's Stephen with a P-H, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, G-I-L-L, G as in go, and he is the senior scientist with NOAA's Center for Operational Oceanographic Products and Services. And Keith Kompoltowitz, and I will spell Keith's last name. Keith is the usual spelling. The last name is K-O-M-P-O-L-T-O-W-I-C-Z, and he is the Watershed Hydrology Branch Chief for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Now, we have slides that could be used to go along with this, and the website for those slides is on the media advisory. I'll read you the URL right now quickly. If you don't have those slides, you can go to them. That would be http://go.usa.gov/W-U-D-H. Okay, now I turn this over to Drew Grunewald.
Thank you, Monica. Briefly, for the next 15 minutes or so, our talk is going to be divided into four categories: a brief overview of the system, followed by a discussion of monitoring systems and the data, followed after that by a discussion of water level drivers, and then finally discussion of regional collaborative modeling projects and also projections. So to begin with, we want to underscore the magnitude of the system that we're dealing with. For those of you who are looking at slides, and you're looking at slide number six, there it summarizes a table of the Earth's largest fresh surface waters. And when we look at those fresh surface waters across the entire planet, we see that when it comes to fresh surface water, nothing else comes close to what the Great Lakes have. When it comes to volume, there are three collective systems that constitute half of the Earth's fresh surface water. Those three systems are the Great Lakes, Lake Tanganyika, and Lake Baikal. And what we want to underscore today is the fact that monitoring and understanding systems like this requires coordination of massive data sets. And we're very fortunate here in the Great Lakes that we not only have a massive monitoring infrastructure with which to understand the Great Lakes system, that we have in place a system for coordinating that data through a group called the Coordinating Committee of Great Lakes Basic Hydraulic and Hydrologic Data. And in fact, that group is not only meeting here in Silver Spring, Maryland this week, but that group has been meeting since the early 1950s, roughly every 6 months, in order to continuously address the problem of water resources management and coordination of data on the Great Lakes. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Stephen and Keith to talk about measurements.
Thanks, Keith. I want to take a few moments to describe, this is Steve Gill with NOAA, and I wanted to take a few minutes to describe our observing systems. some of which is not well known on what it takes to actually measure water levels over sustained periods of time. And we're fortunate to have these coordinated observing systems between Canada and the U.S. And many of our measurements go back over a century that we've been measuring water levels. So it's a sustained observing system that operates, really we intend to operate it forever. We have operated it continuously. So it's a sustained observing system to monitor the lakes. And I'm showing in my first slide a picture of a typical present-day water level station on the Great Lakes. This is Mackinac City, and it shows an instrument shelter, a house, sitting on top of a sump on which the water level sensors reside. But in addition to the water level and the sensors and the data collection platforms inside, many of our stations now have meteorological observations co-located with our water level stations. And we also have, at some of our stations, a continuously operating GPS monitoring sensor. And I'll describe the importance of those sensors in a few slides. So that's a typical station that we have. And now I'm going to run through a series of slides showing the locations of the stations. I'm going to quickly flip through these, but it's just giving you an idea of the distribution of the Canadian and U.S. stations that are monitoring. These are all required to provide precise monitoring and calculation of net flows and calculation of average lake levels that are used to monitor the lakes. And many of these are in major ports. So even in the major ports, the real-time data are valuable for navigation purposes. So Lake Superior, we have a distribution of stations on both sides of both shorelines. And then the next slide is the St. Mary's River. And it's important to note that we have water level stations used to monitor those locks, the Sioux lock systems. And also we have stations at some of the constrictions of our waterways, where it's really important for navigation purposes and dredging purposes to get precise water level information on those narrow constrictions. The next slide, moving on to Lake Michigan, which is all U.S. stations, a distribution of gauges in Lake Michigan. Flowing next into Lake Huron, Lake Huron and Lake Michigan, for hydraulic purposes, are connected through the Straits of Mackinac. But we have both U.S. and Canadian stations, a distribution of stations on that lake as well. And then moving down through the system, as the system flows down towards the ocean, we have the next complex network of stations, probably, and that's in the St. Clair River. We have several stations moving into the St. Clair River and Lake St. Clair, and then to the Detroit River that flows into Lake Erie. And note that there's three entities that we have on this graphic showing there's NOAA gauges that are involved. There's Canadian gauges, the DFO, Department of Fisheries and Oceans. Canada operates those gauges. And then we have the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers also operates a set of gauges for very specific engineering purposes. So moving on from that complex interconnecting waterway into Lake Erie, again, that's a split. So we have a network of stations on both the north and south shores. And moving on from there, from Lake Erie to Lake Ontario, we do have monitoring stations that are very important for the power plants and so forth in monitoring the flows on the Niagara River. And finally, in Lake Ontario, we move in. There's a network of stations on both sides, both shorelines of the Canadian and U.S. side. So we have a very comprehensive network, and it's important that those stations are monitored in real time, but it's also important that it's a sustained observing system, and that takes a lot of effort on both countries. And my last slide in the observing systems, I want to show a schematic, and that's a schematic diagram of showing some of the uniqueness of these stations themselves and what it takes to measure water levels year-round. Now, of course, in the wintertime, there's a severe ice occurs several months, and so we need to measure the water levels through the ice periods. And to do that, we use this sump location. So our water level sensors and gauges sit on top of a sump drilled into the ground, and it has a horizontal pipe going out to the water levels in the lake underneath the depth of the ice. So we're able to measure underneath the ice, measure the water levels of the lake throughout the winter seasons. So these are very expensive to construct and to maintain, but this is what it takes to measure sustained observing system in the lakes, is to have these sump systems and these significant engineering structures. And so these tide houses contain the equipment. And the last component I wanted to make sure that I got across is that we measure water levels relative to the land. And so we survey in the water level sensors to the land to survey benchmarks on the land, which then can be looked at with GPS or can be leveled into national network systems. So that's a brief description of observing systems, and I just wanted to give you that outline.
All right. Good morning, everyone. This is Keith Kompaltowicz. Again, I'm chief of the Watershed Hydrology Branch for the Corps of Engineers in Detroit. My office is a user of the water levels collected by NOAA and the Canadian entity to produce the official coordinated set of monthly mean water levels, which extends back to 1918. Drew mentioned the coordinating committee that is meeting in Silver Spring this week, and that entity is a collaboration of several federal agencies on both sides of the border that meets regularly to coordinate the very data that we work with every day. The Corps of Engineers coordinates water levels with our counterparts in Environment Canada on an annual basis, and the current period of record is 1918 to 2012. In early 2014, we will collect all of the verified data from the gauging agencies to come up with the coordinated set of 2013 water levels, and that will be added to the official period of record. The record low that occurred on Lake Michigan Huron in January of 2013, that was the lowest ever recorded water level going back to 1918, that will be included in that coordination process of the 2013 water levels. If you're looking at slide 11, you know, that shows the long-term fluctuations in water levels going back to the mid-1850s. Prior to 1918, the gauge network was sparsely located around the Great Lakes, and many of those readings are based on only one gauge located around each Great Lake. And that might not necessarily be a true representative mean level for the entire Great Lakes. So in 1918, we started using a coordinated network of gauges around each lake. And again, the coordinating committee had a role in going back and pouring through all of the data that existed to pick that coordinated set of gauges. A couple of things to note on slide 11, the long-term fluctuations in water levels. You see times of above average, below average. The red line on that slide is the long-term average water level for each Great Lakes, for all the Great Lakes, rather. And you can see fluctuations over the long term around that red line. A point of note that for the last 14 years, Lake Superior and Lakes Michigan Huron have been below their long-term averages on a monthly basis. And that's the longest stretch of continuous below average water levels, again, going back to 1918. We started seeing very different basin conditions in the late 1990s that led to a sharp drop in water levels around that time. Since then, we have seen instances of conditions that lend themselves to water levels rising, but not on the consistent basis needed to bring them back to long-term average or above. Just as a point of reference, the record highs and the record lows on the lakes are also a coordinated statistic. And for example, on Lake Michigan, the range between those record highs and record lows is about 6 feet. I will be able to go in depth about the latest forecast, which is also a coordinated product that comes out of the Corps of Engineers office in Detroit. Again, it's a internationally coordinated product. Folks in Environment Canada, we do a forecast at the beginning of each month, and I'll be able to go through those numbers towards the end of our formal discussion and then be able to take questions on those accordingly. So that's a little bit on the the long-term record and the coordination process that goes into coming up with what the water levels are. And I'll turn it back over to Drew Grunwald now for a discussion on the factors that drive water level fluctuation.
Thanks, Keith. So this is Drew Grunwald again from NOAA. We're often asked about what the drivers of water levels are, and it's important to recognize that there are a variety of drivers across different timescales, hourly, daily, monthly, annual, but the biggest driver of changes in water levels that we work on are those that affect the flow of water through the lakes, or what we call the water budget. For those of you looking at slides, slide number 15 provides a synthesis of those major components of the water cycle or the flow of water through the Great Lakes. And there are two take-home points from this slide. One is that when we look at the effects of precipitation falling onto the lakes, evaporation off of the lake surfaces, and runoff coming into the lakes, of the three major components of the water budget, we acknowledge that they are all of comparable orders of magnitude, due in large part to the fact that the lakes have such a massive surface area. But we also acknowledge that, or want to point out, that the monitoring networks for measuring those are, again, part of different federal agencies across the international border that need to be coordinated in order to understand the system. One last thing I want to point out and then move forward in the interest of time is to note that when it comes to monitoring over-lake evaporation on the Great Lakes, there is, in fact, not a formal federally maintained network of stations. And we view the monitoring and understanding of evaporation as one of the more important pioneering research questions for the short-term, if not the long-term future. With that, I want to turn it back over to Keith and Steve if they have any other additional comments on aspects of the water cycle.
This is Keith Kompalski. It's one of the other aspects of the work that the federal agencies that make up the coordinating committee do is estimating and calculating a flow in the connecting channels of the Great Lakes. That's the St. Mary's River, the St. Clair River, the Detroit River, and the Niagara River. A lot of work recently is going into better understanding the changes in the characteristics of those rivers that might impact their ability to flow water in the system. So that is, there's a lot of work that the coordinating committee is doing now in that avenue. Again, this is Keith Kompaltowicz. I'll now move into the latest forecast of water levels for the Great Lakes. And for those looking at slides, that will begin on slide 22 with Lake Superior water levels, November 2013. Again, this is a coordinated product released on the U.S. side out of the Corps of Engineers in Detroit. Folks in Canada can see a similar product that is released out of the Environment Canada office located in Cornwall, Ontario. Again, this is a coordinated product. The numbers that you see on this slide are the same on both sides of the international border. For those looking at the slides, I'll orient you to what you're seeing. You are seeing a blue line, which is the coordinated long-term monthly mean water levels. The red line is the actual recorded monthly mean water level going back to late 2011. You also see above the blue line a dark hatched line with a year that represents the record high monthly mean water level. And then on the lower end of the slide, you see the year with the record low water level. So again, this product is released near the beginning of each month. It is a coordinated product using many different methods to project potential water levels over the next 6 months. The projection part of this slide is represented by the green dashed line and the associated shaded area around that green dashed line. The green line represents the most probable given current conditions. And then we have a shaded area that could water levels could fall into given very wet or very dry conditions over the next 6 months. So for Lake Superior, in October, The water level remained below average. It was 2 inches below its October average. However, that was 13 inches above its levels of a year ago. The forecast over the next 6 months through April for Lake Superior is the lake is projected to remain 2 or 3 inches below its long-term average, but about a foot or so above its levels of a year ago. Note that with very wet conditions over the next several months, Lake Superior could meet or exceed its long-term average, which would be the first time in 14 years that that has occurred. Moving on to Lakes Michigan Huron, it's slide 22B. All of the colors and lines represent the same information. There you notice in late 2012 a record low water level for the month of December, and then you see in January of 2013 another record low. However, we have not coordinated that data yet, so the year still shows 1965. But later on, in the next couple of months, as we coordinate this data, the record low for January will be coordinated, and it will show 2013, which is the lowest monthly mean water level ever recorded on Lakes Michigan Huron, going back to 1918. In October, the lake was 17 inches below its long-term average, however, 11 inches above its levels of a year ago. And over the next 6 months through April, we're expecting to remain about 16 inches below long-term average, but again, about a foot above the levels of a year ago. And even with very dry conditions, we don't see the threat for any new record lows on Michigan Huron over the next 6 months. Moving on quickly to Lake St. Clair. In October, it remained 6 inches below its long-term average. However, again, 10 inches above its levels of a year ago, expected to remain 5 to 7 inches below average over the next 6 months, but again, 6 to 8 inches above its levels of a year ago. Lake Erie was at its long-term average for October, 10 inches above its levels of a year ago, expected to remain near, maybe 3 inches below its long-term average over the next 6 months, but 4 to 5 inches above its levels of a year ago. And then Lake Ontario, which is a regulated lake, it's regulated out of our Corps of Engineers office in Buffalo in coordination. Again, there's that coordination word that often pops up when we're talking about Great Lakes water resources. It's coordinated in among Buffalo Corps of Engineers and Environment Canada in Cornwall. In October, it was 1 inch above average. It's 12 inches above a year ago. It's expected to remain slightly below, so maybe 7 inches below average over the next 6 months, and 10 inches above to near average, near its levels of a year ago over the next 6 months. Again, that's a very quick look at our forecast. Again, that's an internationally coordinated process. Like I said, much of the work that is done on data sets that exist in the Great Lakes Basin. I think at this time we're going to open the line up to questions, and I think the moderator will handle that for us.
Thank you. At this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touchtone phone. Please unmute your phone and record your name clearly when prompted. Once again, that is star 1 to ask a question.
And we would ask that you identify the media outlet that you're from as well.
And one moment while they queue up.
That's okay.
And John Flesher with the Associated Press, your line is open.
Thank you. Just wanted to see if whoever would like to take this. I think, Keith, you have said in the past that it would take probably several years of very wet conditions to get the lakes, most of them anyway, back up to their long-term averages. And I wonder if you could comment on the effect that the wet weather has had this year, how important that has been, and the way things stand right now, how many more years like this year would it take to to get the lakes back on a consistent basis to what we would consider normal after this 14-year slump?
Thanks for the question, John. Good to talk to you. Yes, the conditions that we saw in 2013 were especially conducive to water levels rising. If you go back and look at, and I'll focus on Lakes Michigan Huron, in 2012 we saw conditions, especially in the fall, winter, and spring, that were very dry, and then couple that with a very hot summer in 2012. And if you look at the projection slide for Lakes Michigan Huron, which is slide 22B, you see only a 4-inch seasonal rise in 2012 on Lakes Michigan Huron, and that's the period from February through the month of June. If you look at the blue long-term average, you see that a normal or an average seasonal rise is closer to a foot on Lakes Michigan Huron. So the dry conditions coupled with the warm conditions and hot conditions over the summer, which allowed evaporation to really take hold, got us to that record low that we set in December and January. The calendar flipped over, and so did the conditions. We saw very wet conditions in the winter and spring of 2013, much more snow on the ground, especially across the northern Great Lakes, and significant rainfall in the spring, which at the same time was causing the Great Lakes to rise very quickly, was also causing significant flooding around much of the Great Lakes, especially in towns like Grand Rapids, Michigan, saw significant flooding from the very wet conditions in April. Looking at the seasonal rise in 2013, it was closer to 20 inches on Lakes Michigan Huron. Now, the question is will we see another very wet period in 2014 to continue water levels rising, or will we return to maybe drier conditions, and that could mean losing what we've gained? We have done some simulations based on past water levels, past supplies of water to the Great Lakes, and it would take another couple of years of very wet conditions to get Lakes Michigan Huron back to long-term average. However, notice on Lake Superior over the next couple months, if we were to have wet conditions on Lake Superior could reach or exceed its long-term average later this winter or early in the spring.
And I'd like to add one more comment, if I may, to that. This is Drew Grunewald from NOAA. Keith's points are spot on there. One additional comment to make, though, is that the response of water levels to changes in precipitation is also conditional upon changes in evaporation. Right now, we are in a period that began with the El Nino event in the late 1990s of exceptionally high evaporation. And it could very well be that future water levels could depend largely on whether or not that high evaporation state persists in conjunction with the changes in precipitation. And we're working very closely right now to monitor that situation, not just with regards to the over lake evaporation, but also changes in the temperature of the lakes, and to see whether or not the changes that took place in the late 1990s are going to persist, or if they might actually subside a little bit.
Thank you. And just to follow up on that, you're saying then that the sort of low water crisis that is widely regarded as such is not over by any means, even with the wet year we've had this year?
The very wet conditions we saw allowed the lakes to have a very healthy seasonal rise. However, Lakes Superior and Lake Michigan Huron still remain below their long-term average.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Keith Matheny, Detroit Free Press. Your line is open. You may ask your question.
Hello. John stole a bit of my thunder, but I'm wondering if any of you could comment on putting in perspective the level of change that we saw within the past year. Historically, is it a surprising turnaround from the rather dire numbers of late 2012, early 2013?
Sure. This is Keith Kompaltowicz again from the Corps of Engineers. In our investigation into seasonal rises going back to 1918, the seasonal rise on Lake Superior and the seasonal rise on Lakes Michigan Huron were in the top percentage of seasonal rises ever recorded, again, going back to 1918. Looking at Lake Superior, it was, again, close to, you know, a 20 or so inch seasonal rise when on average it's closer to a foot. So that just speaks to how extremely wet conditions were in the springtime, with snowmelt combined with rainfall that allowed the lakes to rise very quickly.
And to follow up, you mentioned that we're still below historical averages. However, are we at levels that you wouldn't expect there to be such significant issues with shipping and with boat docks and boat launches like we saw within the last couple of years?
That is certainly, you know, something that with below average water levels, there are still going to be impacts to those groups. We aren't looking at record-setting conditions by any stretch of the imagination over the next 6 months, but we are still looking at below average water levels, especially on Lakes Michigan Huron, which certainly does impact shipping. It impacts shoreline property owners, marina owners, the recreational boater, and so on and so forth. So, yes, we saw a healthy seasonal rise, but again, we still remain below average on Lakes Michigan Huron.
One important observation, this is Drew Grunewald again from NOAA, to complement what Keith was just saying, is that not only did we have a healthy rise in the spring, but it's important to notice that the water level drop that led prior to that spring, that led to the record lows, was also rather anomalous as well, not just within the system, but across the entire Great Lakes system. If you look down a lake, Lake Erie, at the same time, actually went through an unprecedented period where it dropped for 10 continuous months. That had never happened before in recorded history. A second part of that is to look at when the last low water level records were set for this time period. They were set on a period of 12 consecutive months. So what that means is that water levels in 1964, when that was set, were low for almost a year across all those months. This most recent low really was a dramatic drop, a couple of months where we hit those record lows and then a very dramatic rise again. It's just an important perspective to have on how the system was reacting over those two different time periods.
And are you ready for the next question?
Yes, we are. Thanks.
Tom Henry, Toledo Blade, your line is open.
Yeah, I know we're focused on 2014, but yesterday we, those of us who were on a webinar, had heard from a University of Illinois climatologist talking about long-term climate change forecasts and saying that there's still kind of a mixed bag and not a clear consensus if, you know, the long-term, mid-century, and later this century, you know, we're expecting lower or sustained or even higher water levels for the Great Lakes. I was wondering, you know, although we're focused on 2014, what kind of analysis you guys may have, since the Corps and NOAA have the best data that's used for a lot of these longer range projections, and you know, just based on what you've seen going back to the 1800s, can you put that into some kind of perspective of what we may expect to see beyond 2014?
Sure. This is Drew Grunewald from NOAA. I'm happy to take an initial stab at this question. I'd like to propose that we break the response into sort of two categories, one being sort of the next 2 to 10 years of what might be happening, and then looking at projections far beyond that that rely at much larger circulation models to indicate what the climate might be. In both time periods, it is very difficult to determine what's going to happen with water levels, as you indicated in your question, because water levels depend so much on the subtle interplay between not just precipitation and evaporation, but by how much more one is greater than the other or by these changes in the water budget. We can have reasonable projections of both precipitation and evaporation, but it is the differences between those that lead to the changes in water levels, and that's what makes this problem challenging. It also is indeed true that when we look at projections of both climates and then propagate those climate change projections into water levels, looking out decades, 20, 50, or 100 years, we see a broad range of variability that really reflects our uncertainty in what those climate patterns are going to be.
Okay. Frank Quinn used to always tell us reporters that, you know, instead of looking at 1 or 2 year, if you kind of look in grouping 30-year trends, that he used to say this years ago, that the hydrology of the Great Lakes for decades now has kind of been roughly 30-year trends between highs and lows. Can you still say that now because of what's happened in Superior and Lake Michigan, Huron? Do you think that we're in a 30-year trend here? And I know that's one of the great unknowns, is if we're just in a low water era, or if this is a climate change era.
Yeah, this is Keith Cabaltos from the Corps of Engineers. Keep in mind that our coordinated data set of water levels only goes back to 1918. It's not even 100 years of data to look at. And to say with any sort of confidence that there are cycles of water levels in only less than 100 years of data, it's just not possible to do that. What we can say is we have had periods of high water, we have had periods of low water, and the difficulty in forecasting water levels, even on a six-month basis, can be very difficult. If you go back to our forecasts that were done at the end of 2012, we were projecting several months in a row of record low water on Lakes Michigan Huron. That, of course, ended with only a two-month stretch, and then water levels rose very quickly. So, you know, projections at the time are based on the best available information that's available to us and what the current basin conditions are. And things can change very quickly, and subsequent forecasts then are adjusted. The forecast that we released at the beginning of November, again, is based on our best information and the best analyses of several different forecasting methods. However, something could change in the grand scheme of things that makes these forecasts complete busts.
And just one last follow-up. Drew, since you had brought up ice cover, and I'm glad you did, because that's a huge issue down here in Lake Erie, and I'm sure you know that you know, we don't get the ice cover that we used to have years ago, where people used to be able to drive out on the lake in the middle of the winter time and so forth. Yesterday they were even talking about the winter rain that we never used to see, that's now almost an annual occurrence over the last decade, and the December rain, you know, that may be more of a factor in runoff in future years. I guess what I'm asking about, if you could maybe elaborate more about that interplay that you talked about between precipitation and ice cover, because, you know, you need the ice to seal off the evaporation, and it seems to be coming later and leaving earlier, and how does that inconsistency, or maybe shorter window of ice cover, how has it changed in recent years, and how does it affect your projections?
Right. This is Drew from NOAA. That is a great question that touches on a lot of sort of complicated topics. You mentioned both changes in how precipitation is falling and how snow might even be accumulating on the landscape, and then also touched upon the seasonal onset and breakup of ice. So I want to talk first about, respond to your question about ice cover. It is indeed true that ice plays an incredibly important role in the water budget and in evaporation. Now, what's I think, important as a take-home message here is there is a group of researchers on the Great Lakes right now, including John Lenters, as well as Peter Blanken and Chris Spence from Environment Canada. Those three gentlemen have been doing some pioneering research about what is actually happening out over the surfaces of the lakes with regard to ice cover and evaporation. And what they're finding is that it is not necessarily true that ice cover sort of caps evaporation in the winter months, and that increases in evaporation are directly related to just decreases in ice. It's a much more complicated process, mm-hmm. where, in fact, warmer waters in the fall may, in fact, be leading to rapid acceleration of evaporation during that time period, and that we see proportionally less of the evaporation happening in the winter months, whether or not there is actually ice.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, I didn't. I got John Lenter, Chris Spence, and who was the other one?
John Lenters, Chris Spence, and then the third gentleman, his name is Peter Blanken. He's with University of Colorado Boulder, and those
okay.
three gentlemen have part of a network of a very small network of evaporation stations that they're using to learn about this process.
Yeah, I know the energy is much greater, and most people don't realize that there's actually, until the lake freezes, that the evaporation is greater in wintertime than it is in the summertime, and because of the variances and difference between air and water temperatures. So, anyways, thanks a lot.
Thank you. And our next question comes from John Myers, Duluth News. Your line is open. You may ask your question.
Thanks much. I just wanted to get... look at a little bit closer why you expect Superior to sort of not keep getting closer to that normal level. I mean, you've got it very close, and you said that, if we get a wetter than normal winter, we could actually go above it. But the trend for many, many months has been inching closer and closer and closer to normal, and it sounds like you expect that now to stop. Or is it too close to call? I mean, we're within sort of the normal range of variability now. But why do you think that closing gap will not close much more?
Good question. This is the time of year that all of the Great Lakes are in their periods of seasonal decline.
Yeah, you're talking now?
This is Keith Kompaltowicz from the Corps of Engineers.
Thanks, Keith.
The projection for Lake Superior, the most probable projection is for it to remain slightly below average. That is based on weather projections over the next several months, looks at from other agencies that do some of the longer term climate projections. NOAA issues 1 and 3 month climate projections that we use, and we also do our own statistical analyses on what we call net basin supply of water to the lakes. And those net basin supplies of water that we have seen, it looks like on the most probable scale, again, the green line on the chart is we're looking at water levels, again, slightly 2 to 3 inches below average based on the best available information that's out there now. And again, the forecast part of this can change very quickly. We have seen, looking at precipitation so far during the month of November, it's been a very wet month across the Lake Superior Basin. The basin has received 134% of its average precip so far this month. So that would be an indication that we might still be seeing wetter conditions. But at the time we made the forecast, those projections that we used showed a little bit less water coming into the system.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Our next question comes from William Marsden, Post Media News. Your line is open. You may ask your question.
Hi. Thank you. I have two questions. First of all, how does this affect, or how will it continue to affect, the seaway traffic through areas like the ports of Montreal, Niagara, Sault Ste. Marie? That's the first question, and I'm looking, 10 years down the line or more. The second question is is given the changes that we're seeing over the last decades in climate and various areas of climate in North America and around the Great Lakes watershed, are we sort of looking at, or is there anything that indicates to you that we're looking at a new norm for these lakes in their water levels?
Sure. This is Keith Kapalowicz. I'll be happy to touch on the impacts. Certainly when you have low water levels, the navigation industry is affected. Depending on where their trip originates from and where they are going, they have to adjust their cargo load appropriately. A lot of times with low water levels, the big commercial freighters that we see on the Great Lakes are forced to light load, meaning they aren't putting the full capacity of whatever commodity they're shipping. That, in turn, means they have to make more trips, which costs the shipping company more money, and that certain extra cost has to get passed on somewhere, and it's usually to the consumer. There are, depending, again, that's completely dependent on where your ports of origination and your delivery ports are, and then, you know, as you're making your way through the Great Lakes system, you know, water levels, they have to take the current conditions of water levels along their route into question. For your second question, I'll turn it over to Drew to talk about some of the longer-term climate projections, if you will.
Thanks, Keith. So, yeah, this is Drew Grunewald again from NOAA. Regarding your question about changing climates and whether or not we've entered sort of a new hydrologic regime, that is a great question. I think it's important to distinguish between almost two different time periods, a time period leading up to the 1998 El Nino event, which was one of the strongest El Nino events ever recorded, and the post-El Nino period. Prior to the 1998 El Nino, our research indicates that water levels largely responded to long-term changes in precipitation because it was changes in precipitation that were more profound than changes in evaporation. However, during that time period, we were seeing both gradual and persistent long-term increases in both precipitation and evaporation. In 1998 and 1999, evaporation accelerated rapidly, and it has stayed much higher than it usually is for the past 15 years. So that sort of provides the context for answering your question. We don't know if this new regime in which evaporation is extraordinarily high is going to persist, or if perhaps it's a sort of a shock to the system or a perturbation that came about because of that 1998 El Nino. We simply don't know. We are going to continue to monitor and watch the system to try to understand it better.
Thank you very much. That was very interesting.
Thank you. And our next party is T.J. Pignataro. Your line is open.
Thank you. A couple of quick questions. The first is, Keith, you had mentioned some of the forecasts for each individual lake. Is that available? I was trying to write as quick as I could, but is that available online somewhere as to, some of the statistics that you had stated?
Yes, absolutely. If you go to the, again, this is Keith Kapalowicz.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to the Detroit District homepage, and I'll read off the URL, it's www.lre.usace.army.mil. That's our homepage. And on our homepage, there is a nice convenient button called Water Levels. If you click on that water level button, you're taken to another page where you can access our forecasts, sets of statistics. And I should add that our water level forecast that I've been mentioning today is available online as well, access through that water level button on our homepage. And it's also available in the mail via the Postal Service if you'd like to receive it. if you are interested in receiving the monthly bulletin of water levels, that's our six-month forecast, please send an email to hhpm@usace.army.mil and with your address, and we'd be happy to include you on our mailing list. Keep in mind that we are only authorized to mail this to folks in the United States. The Canadian, you have to contact the Canadian entities for information on how to receive the Canadian version of the bulletin.
Okay. Thank you for that. Couple of other questions. In terms of the precipitation evaporation thing that we've been talking about today, where, you know, where does that water that evaporates ultimately go? If it's, is it, it's fair to say it's taken out of the Great Lakes watershed. Does it wind up somewhere else, or is it just in the atmosphere? Or
This is Keith Kompalsowitz. The best example I can give, and being from the Great Lakes and growing up in the Great Lakes, and those of us that have spent a lot of time in the Great Lakes, we're all aware of a phenomenon called lake effect snow. Lake effect snow is just a way of life in the Great Lakes system. It is a result of evaporation from open water. As that moisture evaporates into the atmosphere and the flow of the atmosphere brings it on shore, the friction that exists on land causes continual rising of that very moist air. Clouds build, and you can get several feet of snow from the lake effect machine, as we like to call it, in just a short amount of time. You know, that lake effect snow is the direct result of evaporation from the Great Lakes. It is not a guarantee, however, that that moisture that falls in the form of snow makes it back to the lake it originated from. Sometimes it is evaporated again into the atmosphere and carried outside of the basin. Sometimes it is absorbed into the ground. Other times it makes its way as runoff into one of the other Great Lakes or another hydrologic system separate from the Great Lakes. So that's just one very specific example of evaporation and what might happen to evaporated water when it leaves the Great Lakes.
Mm-hmm. How about, is there any, we haven't really talked at all about the role that diversions might play, whether it's, you know, water that's taken out of the lakes for hydraulic fracturing, you know, bottling, municipal water supplies or anything. Is that just so minuscule that it doesn't play any role here, or does it, in fact, play a role?
For the most part, the diversions that you had mentioned, the consumptive use diversions, are very minuscule compared to the grand scheme of things in Great Lakes water budget analysis. Now, there are a number of diversions in the Great Lakes that serve purposes for hydropower. There are two diversions in the Lake Superior Basin that divert water from northern Ontario into the Great Lakes system. There's also the diversion at Chicago, which reversed the flow of the Chicago River. That diverts water out of the Great Lakes Basin. It's very important to note that the water that's diverted into the Great Lakes Basin in Lake Superior is greater than the amount diverted out at Chicago. So the large diversion so that we look at, there's more water diverted in than diverted out, and that's a very important point to make.
Okay. I appreciate that. Thank you.
And our next question comes from Kathy Kowalski, freelance. Your line is open. You may ask your question.
Thank you. I have two very disparate questions. The first one is somewhat related to what Keith was just talking about. I understand that the Army Corps is currently doing a study to see whether to re-reverse the Chicago River in order to try to keep the Asian carp out. And I'm wondering if any of the models are looking at how that might affect the low lake levels. In other words, how much of an effect could we see in terms of perhaps getting higher levels in Michigan and Huron? And then the second question is for Drew. I'm wondering to what effect or to what extent we've seen any correlation between water quality in the lakes where the levels are lower and the lake levels. In other words, it seems as if you'd think somewhat lower lakes might mean more concentration of pollutants or more problems with algal blooms. And I'm wondering if there's been any work done looking at how low lake levels are affecting the water quality.
All right, this is Keith Kompaltowicz. For questions relating to the study that's ongoing about the aquatic invasive species, including the Asian carp, we have to refer you to the Chicago District of the Corps of Engineers, and we can get you a contact at the Chicago District that might be able to better address Asian carp issues and aquatic invasive species issues. Now, the water that is diverted at Chicago, many years ago it was much more. The Supreme Court issued a decree limiting the amount of water diverted at Chicago to about 3,200 cubic feet per second. The Corps of Engineers in Chicago is one of the technical agencies involved in making sure that the diversion meets the Supreme Court decree and does not exceed over the long term that amount. Those studies are released on a couple-year lag because of the great amount of technical work that has to go into that analysis. Again, the current rate of diversion is about 3,200 cubic feet per second over time, and if you were to do some very simple arithmetic, that is 1 inch of water in a year over Lakes Michigan Huron. So in the grand scheme of things, it's not an impact to low water levels. And further on to that, those diversions into the Great Lakes system at Lake Superior average about 5,500 or so cubic feet per second. So there's a net gain of about 2,000 cubic feet per second. And over time, that net gain in terms of diversion has added water to the Great Lakes.
Okay. And on the water quality and low lake levels?
Sure. Yeah, great question. This is Drew Grunewald from NOAA responding to that question. I am not aware of studies that directly relate water levels, and in particular recently low water levels, to water quality. That does not mean that they are not out there. I'm just simply not aware of them. But I do think it's an important area for current and future research. However, I am aware of studies, some of which were presented at the most recent International Association for Great Lakes Research Conference, that identified some pretty interesting trends in coastal aquatic habitat that took place in the late 1990s. Now, it is not entirely clear whether those changes took place purely because of a water level drop or because of some of the things that also led to the water level drop, such as changes in temperature. So, great question, and that's sort of the extent of my knowledge on that topic.
Okay, thank you.
We have time for one more question.
And our last question comes from Tom Henry, Toledo Blade. Your line is open.
Drew, just real quick, if I believe I've seen some research. There's now some research going on with all the Lake Erie algae issue going on about a lower water level for Lake Erie with more precipitation impacting the, you know, accelerating the runoff and what that may have. And I can't quote it to you exactly, but I think that's where some of the research is going right now is the lowering of how water levels of Lake Erie, you know, come into play with algae growth. But anyways, my question that I wanted to ask is a little more straightforward, hopefully. I was intrigued when you said that the evaporation rate for the lakes has accelerated since the 1989 El Nino, and that it's remained accelerated for the past 15 years. I'm wondering, as a scientist and other scientists you deal with, is there a consensus that that is a climate change impact? I mean, are we at the point of saying that, you know, one of the climate change impacts is an accelerated evaporation rate for Lake Erie and the other lakes, or are you not comfortable saying that yet?
So that is a great question.
This is Drew.
Thank you. Yeah, this is Drew Grunewald responding to your question from NOAA. Mm-hmm. In response to that question, I would say that I and other scientists would agree that the rapid acceleration of evaporation in the late 1990s, along with the sudden decrease in ice temperature and increases in water temperature, are best explained by the El Nino event that took place during that time. However, changes in evaporation and water surface temperature and ice cover prior to that time are certainly indicative of a changing climate, and that's been documented by a range of scientists, one of whom is Jay Austin, who has published some really great papers on the relationship between changes in regional air temperature, most importantly, increases in air temperature, and a more rapid rate of acceleration of water temperatures prior to the El Nino event.
Thank you. We're going to now close out our conference with some last comments by our panelists, and I want to thank everybody for calling in. And if you have any questions, you can email me, and I'll try to follow up with you. My email is Monica, M-O-N-I-C-A, dot Allen, A-L-L-E-N, at NOAA, N-O-A-A, dot gov. And now I turn it over to our panelists for closing comments.
Keith Compaldwitz here, Corps of Engineers. The word coordination is a very popular word when talking about Great Lakes data and why the Great Lakes react the way they do. And the group that's meeting here in Silver Spring today and tomorrow has been meeting, that's the coordinating committee, has been meeting regularly since 1952 and will continue to work very hard to better understand the dynamics that make up the Great Lakes system.
This is Steve Gill with NOAA, and I just wanted to make an additional point on our observing systems. Our long-term observing system network is a bilateral one with Canada. And one aspect that I mentioned before is the monitoring of continuous GPS systems that we're starting to put into our co-location of our network. And that's important to monitor vertical land velocities. And due to that post-glacial rebound phenomenon, we know that the northern part of the lakes, the land is emerging, and the southern part of the lakes, the land is subsiding. There's a differential. And that has long-term implications on hydraulic flow of the lakes. So our lake level stations are monitoring the lake levels, but we're also monitoring through these GPS systems the dynamics of the land, of the vertical velocities. And that's an important consideration moving forward.
And finally, this is Drew Grunewald from NOAA with my final comments. One of the things that the federal agencies, Environment Canada, USGS, NOAA, and the Army Corps are trying to do is not just communicate the data we're talking about today to the general public and decision makers, but do it in a way that allows people to answer their own questions about the data, similar to the sort of questions we've had today. And one of the many tools we've developed for that is the Water Levels Dashboard and its follow-up, the Hydroclimate Dashboard. These are interactive tools that have been developed specifically for that purpose to help answer questions about this system.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and that does conclude today's conference call. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time.